Well, it's pretty darn near post-pandemic, or PDMPP. What did we learn? That one guy in 20 will Zoom with his pants down.
Of things I should be thankful for, I've had a great share. And as I sit in the comfort of a cozy chair, my fancy takes me to a humble east-side tenement, three flights in the rear to where my childhood days were spent. It wasn't much like paradise, but amid the dirt and all, that the sweetest thing to one that I fondly call my Yiddish.
Mama, that's Ethel Merman, of course. And that was my Yiddish mama. Geraldine Goldie Feldman. Happy Mother's Day. And to everyone.
Oh.
Mom, I'm going to put you over here for now. I'll talk to you later. I talk to her every day. The good thing about that is that, you know, I don't know how you... I am actually both my mother and my father. Day to day, I'm my mother. You know, take a piece of fruit. Why don't you go lie down? don't drag your feet when you walk. Put your head straight. Well, that was Howard's. Man. Howard used to walk with his head. I don't know why. But overall, mostly I'm, all my invectives and asides are my dad. So they're still here with me. And it's occasionally a burden.
Well,
but I was occasionally a burden to them. Well, you know, the big question to me now is, what is a metaverse? I said we're going to do this old fart night, you know, because everyone's doing Fortnite. Fortnite is suing Apple, and you got to wish them well on that, because Apple is just one of the dark forces in the universe, along with Amazon and Musk. Musk everywhere. The smell of Musk is everywhere. But I was reading around one of Epic versus Apple opens with a tour. The popular gaming platform is more than just a game. It's a metaverse.
Oh.
In court, they try to decide what a metaverse was. Do you know what a metaverse is?
No idea.
I don't either.
A universe with a lot of metas.
Yeah. What do they say it is? Fortnite is a phenomenon that transcends gaming. Our aim at Fortnite is to build something like a metaverse from science fiction. Metaverse, a court reporter needed clarification. It's a virtual Why don't they continue them on the next page like they used to? There it is. World for socializing and entertainment. It's a virtual world for socializing and entertainment. So that's what we need, I figured. And I hope they, and as apparently Apple is charging like a 30% of everything they make, and they make a ton of money on there from selling virtual objects. Skins for their characters and weapons and bullets and virtual bullets, I guess.
It's slightly creepy.
I know, but I thought we should be part of this. You know, because it's what's happening now. I'm tired of trying to not do everything that's being done. I want a metaverse, multi-metaverse. If you've got to pay Apple 30% for protection, you know, that's protection. Just the way it is. Yeah. How do they make money? They sell. Their business model is to, in Battle Royale, 100 players drop onto a storm-torn island and survive, fight, or build their way through a shrinking map in order to be the last one. Say, how is this virtual? This is what's happening. See, suddenly I lost interest in it. That's just nothing. But they sell all this stuff, and there's all these things, a spinoff. For example, here's Funko Pop.
Excuse me?
Yeah, Funko Pop. Glitter up and giddy up your Funko collection with a Fortnite Pop featuring the giddy up outfit from the game. So it's, you know, it's a good thing for diversity, obviously, Fortnite. Okay. You can get a Fortnite RL Super Soaker Water Blaster for $19.99 at Kohl's. It's a water blaster for adults. Oh, yeah. It should be adults. Where is that guy? I had a picture of the guy who's actually using all of this. He was like 24 years old. I don't know.
Almost an adult.
That's it for Fortnite.
Long may it wave.
Long may it wave. Now all the news that isn't for May the 8th, 2021. Ha ha. Science fiction days. It is World Migratory Bird Day, so all you migratory birds, get at it. And in all the news, it isn't. Dear Mrs. Biden, to summarize our student-teacher meeting, the other boys will not play with Joe because he wants to too badly. This is an unusual problem, and we recommend Joe meet with a counselor and get involved with after-school club activities. In other news still, a 10-story, 23-ton piece of Chinese rocket will crash into Earth sometime over this weekend. No one knows where, but my guess, Taiwan. South Carolina goes pro-choice, offers death row inmates either firing squads or the electric chair. Now that nobody can vote in Texas or Florida, they'll be able to repurpose those stadium fan cutouts for their congressional seats. In football, Aaron Rodgers will stay and the Packers will go. The GOP leadership had better watch out for the Wyoming Cheneys. McCarthy will wake up with a horse head on a pillow where his wife used to be. Arizona GOP vote auditors bring in pandas to eat bamboo ballots. Here's actually one of those auditors working right now.
Aww.
An Arizona vote ballot auditor.
So adorable.
Examining the bamboo ballots. There you go. Under Arizona law, legislators can vandalize, throw out, and feed the pandas ballots, forms, legal dispositions, mail, etc., as necessary for governance and general interest.
Oh.
They don't even have to show a reason. It's just they want, well, yeah. I need to give me all the boxes of this, whatever. Facebook clarifies what they mean by suspend. They mean to actually suspend Donald Trump from something that will hold him.
Impossible.
There's the hang up, something that will hold him.
Yes.
A gas station sign, something like that. Today on What's My Line, Bennett Cerf would ask, is there something perhaps non-fungible about this object you possess? John Daly. You could say that. $5 down, Mr. Gallon. That's for no one out there knows what that is. But maybe the guy who's hacking me all the time. Enjoy that. A town in Japan spent $230,000 in COVID relief funds on a 43-foot squid statue. But, heck, it's pretty cool. Look at that.
Wow.
As far as squid statues go, that's one of the best I've seen. Here in Wisconsin, Governor Tony Evers wants to borrow $66 million to construct a new unit at Mendota Mental Health Center to house the Republican majority. So there'll be about 80 beds in the legislative unit there at Mendota. Yeah. Melinda Gates to wed Mackenzie Scott and rule the world. Apple Watch now nags you about blood pressure, glucose, and blood alcohol. It's like a wife on your wrist.
Ah.
And a woman gives birth on Delta flight. That's right, Delta's ready when you are. Of course, on Southwest, you are now free to birth around the country.
Hmm.
That's all the news. That isn't.
Oh, well, a young man ain't nothing in this world these days. I said a young man ain't nothing in this world these days. In the old days, when a young man was a strong man, all the people stand back when the young man walked by. But nowadays, the old man got all the money, and a young man ain't nothing in this world these days.
I have to get high from being hacked so I can put it in perspective. Cool. No, Mose Allison, Young Man Blues. That's from about 1956 or 8.
Holy cow.
Yeah, so he was a young man when he sang that one. The great Mose Allison. Saw him one time down in Chicago. Nothing in the world for a young man these days. All of the old men have the money. But I'll tell you what, we're paying a lot of taxes on it. So it ain't so great being an old man. But I felt the same way when I was a young man. What the hell?
Yeah.
Everyone does, right?
I guess, you know. Who knows?
Yeah. What about this? Belgian farmer accidentally moves French border. That's pretty good news.
Well.
Yeah.
By accident.
A farmer in Belgium has caused a stir after inadvertently redrawing the country's border with France. A local history enthusiast was walking in the forest. Well, that's a nice beginning to any story.
Sounds like a joke.
Yeah. When he noticed the stone marking the boundary between the two countries had moved 2.29 meters, or 7.5 feet. He's a very accurate history enthusiast.
He had a measuring tape.
Apparently. The Belgian farmer apparently, annoyed by the stone in his tractor's path, had moved it inside French territory.
Oh, no. Mon Dieu!
Instead of causing international uproar, the incident has been met with smiles on both sides of the border.
Oh.
He made Belgium bigger and France smaller. It's not a good idea. David Laval, mayor of the Belgian village of Equelin, told French TV channel TF1. That sort of move caused a headache between private landowners, he pointed out, let alone neighboring states. The border between France and what is now Belgium stretches 620 kilometers. That's 390 miles, Charlie. It was formally established under the Treaty of Kortrijk, signed in 1820 after Napoleon's defeat at Waterloo 5 years earlier. The stone dates back to 1819 when the border was first marked out. In fact, it says 1819. This is this actual stone. Hard to see.
It's been there a long time.
Yeah. You think the farmer would have noticed it being in his field since 1819.
You'd think.
Right. He finally couldn't take it anymore. So after how many hundred years?
So he moved it 2.9
200 years later.
Yeah.
Yeah. God damn it. Plow the thing out back into France. Probably said that. But they speak French on both sides. Belgium, they speak French, right? No, they have what?
Well, in that part of Belgium, I think they do, yeah.
Yeah. What's the other thing they speak there? Pantaloon?
No, they speak Flemish.
Flemish, yeah. I was happy my town was bigger, the Belgian mayor added with a laugh, but the mayor of Woensen-sur-Roch didn't agree. I like my French a lot better than it used to be, isn't it? The farmer will now be asked to move the stone back to its original position. We should be able to avoid a new border war. All the mayors are just so right on this. You know, this would have been bloodshed a few years back. And a few years to come, same thing.
Yeah.
But local Belgian authorities plan to contact the farmer to ask him to return the stone to its original location. If that does not happen, the case could end up at the Belgian Foreign Ministry, which would have to summon a Franco-Belgian border commission dormant since 1930.
Well,
yeah.
Time to wake them up.
Yeah. Dormant since just before Hitler had something to do about the borders.
And they've never reconstituted it since. Oh, well.
Yeah. Mr. Laveau noted that the farmer could also face criminal charges if he fails to comply. I'm hoping this will go that way. Makes a better story. If he shows goodwill, we won't have a problem. We'll settle this issue amicably.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And a good time was had by all.
Yeah. Have you had any cicadas by you? You know, we had the guy on here, the cicada guy from the UW.
We don't live out east, so I don't think we're going to hear them.
Yeah, these are not ours.
No.
Ours are still on the ground. I don't know when they're coming out.
Yeah, we've got a different kind here.
Yeah, this is the X. Generation X cicada. Gen X. The ones over there are 17 years. I think ours might be 13 years.
Yeah, ours are different years.
Yeah.
I read that somewhere.
Yeah. But it turns out you can eat them.
Yes.
That's the good news. Did you know that, Jerry?
Yes, if you can stomach them, more power to you.
Yeah. Have you ever known anyone who has eaten one, or have you ever attempted to eat one? If offered a cicada, would you eat it if prepared properly? No?
No, I don't think so.
Okay. Have you eaten any insects?
No.
Willingly? Sometimes it flies in there, you know. Oops, pardon me. It's just a me to myself.
It's culturally kind of, icky.
Yeah.
It's not part of our Western culture. We're taught as little kids that, you know, if a child puts a bug in their mouth, you know, your mother comes along and
slaps the bug. Silly.
Yes, slaps it out of their hands. And so we're taught at an early age that, no, you don't eat earthworms and bugs and things.
Well, you have really vehement feelings about this. How long has this been bottled up?
You're just reacting it in a fortnight.
Anyhow, Carolyn Goon had just heard that the cicadas that swarmed the D.C. area were edible. After considering different advice on how to eat them, with or without wings, headless, or head-on, the 20-year-old went to a tree near her apartment in Wheaton, Maryland, pulled a few cicadas off, and gave them a quick fry. The result? I remember distinctly that, at the time, it tasted like a crispy, salty-ish snack. She's got a good attitude. That Carolyn Goon.
Good for her.
Insect eating, a.k.a. entomophagy. Entomophagy.
Excuse me?
Entomophagy. Entomophagy. It's not common in the United States, where prevalent cultural norms include a disgust factor.
Yes, the disgust factor.
But now they're promoting it, and the Eastern chefs are working on it. Turns out their tenero and nymph stages are ideal for eating. Okay. Tenero is when they're just leaving their skin behind.
Yeah.
And they come out and they're like naked cicadas. You know,
very tasty.
They don't look any more attractive. I wish I had one here to show you, but they haven't come out here yet. The challenge with eating them actually is it's a short live between when they get out and when they go on to their next stage, which is annoying everybody for miles around.
And then they're not tasty anymore?
No. You got to get them when they're tenero.
Fresh. Yeah.
Tenero. This means roasting, frying, turning them into a powder, attempting to cook them live like lobster, perhaps figure out if you can salt cure the eggs like caviar, this guy here.
Hmm.
He's the director of Brooklyn Bugs, which can only exist in Brooklyn, not just for the assonance. Salt cure the eggs like caviar. Oh, I hope he doesn't find out that you can do that. Protein in our diet. And I'll tell you that Bella loves these little crickets.
Oh.
The crickets, and they come mixed. Some are with peas, and some are with sweet potatoes, and they're little pellets and stuff. And she loves, and that's pure protein, no fat.
Yeah.
She swears by them. This guy has nicknamed cicadas tree shrimp. How are you otherwise?
Oh, I'm great.
Yeah. You're getting out a lot more, aren't you? Restaurant dining and such?
Yes, although it's a struggle.
What's the struggle about it?
Well, you have to fight with the kids and stuff because they're overtaking. Because they're getting out and about too, and so they places get crowded.
Well, I see. You have to make reservations in places you didn't.
And you have to make reservations. Oh, don't get me started about reservations. Oh, Lord.
Why? What's the matter with the reservation? That's a good idea, isn't it?
Yes, in theory, but you go to the reservations and then everything is taken.
And then you have reservations about reservations.
Yes, and then you click on, well, how about June 14th? Well, there's nothing available then either.
It's like surgery. It's like trying to get surgery. They put you 2 months down the lines, but it's eating in a restaurant.
Yeah.
If they operated on you at the same time, then it would be worth waiting for.
Yeah, then, double.
How long did you have to wait for your most recent reservation?
I couldn't get a reservation because the app wouldn't work.
Oh, your app wouldn't work.
Yeah. You're
the same guy's, this guy's hacking you too.
Maybe, yeah. I got to investigate the metaverse.
That leaves only John Philip Sousa. And that, I turn it over to you, Lyle Anderson.
Well, if you've ever wondered about him.
I never have you?
Well, let me tell you.
You already knew about him. Yeah.
When John Philip Sousa's mother told him to march right upstairs to bed, she didn't have to ask him twice. Born on November the 6th, 1854, in the Pipedown section of Washington, D.C. I wonder if that was a cicada year. John Philip was the third of 10 children, his immigrant parents apparently not realizing they had a winner and could quit.
Yeah.
The boy was something of a...
Wait a minute, though. Where did he immigrate from?
Well, one was from Portugal and one was from Bavaria.
His parents came from different places. They immigrated together and somehow met on the docks?
Maybe they met on the boat. You know how these things
go. No wonder he wrote songs on boats.
Oh, that's right. He wrote...
Yeah, a lot of them were on boats.
Well, he had not only perfect pitch, but a remarkable ability to sight read.
Oh.
And he had the fullest beard of any boy his age. Moreover, Philip, as he was called, was composing pieces in his head, even when it appeared to others that he was merely scowling, a lifelong trait of his, which means that if you have one picture of John Philip Sousa, Indian headdresses and honorary mortarboards aside, you have them all. The son of a marine band trombonist.
You're such a good writer. I'm enjoying this, even though I don't care about John Philip Sousa.
This
is like something I would write if I ever had a chance.
Remarkable. The one instrument, trombone, he never could master. Philip had ample opportunity to hear military music in the Washington of his day, which left an indelible mark, resembling something made by a baton, on the young man who had arguably become the most popular American, let alone composer, of his day.
Yeah.
At age 12.
Arguably is a key word there.
Which was?
Arguably.
Arguably.
Yeah.
Yeah, you can, covers a lot of ground.
It does.
At age 12, the precocious Philip, having studied violin and composition, formed a 7-piece dance orchestra, including trombone, fife, drum, clarinet, and himself on violin and maybe some other instruments. At 13, young Sousa attempted to run away with a circus band and was promptly enrolled by his father, Antonio, as an apprentice in the United States Marine Band.
No, that didn't happen.
He rose after 7 years.
Wait a minute.
Yes?
Young Sousa wanted to run away with the circus?
He wanted to run away to the circus, and his dad found him and put him in the Marines.
The Marine Corps Band.
Yes. It would be 50 years and another two enlistments later that Sousa, upon retiring from his World War I Naval Band training program, would finally qualify for the Naval Reserve's lieutenant's uniform that he would eat, drink, and conduct in for the rest of his life.
Wait a minute. This covers a lot of ground, this particular.
It was a long enlistment.
When does he become John Philip Sousa that we know and don't love that much?
Oh, he was always, he was born that way.
I mean the marches and stuff. This is still a childhood, aren't we? When do we get to the good
stuff? Oh, no, no. We're talking about, you know, into World War I. That's 1918.
Okay, good. That's a start.
Yeah, he was like 60 by then. Or so.
Yeah.
He loved the military. Mm-hmm. During his youth as a Marine, though, Philip learned to play virtually every band instrument, to conduct, and to begin his unbroken string of compositions, up to Opus 135 by age 15 when he stopped numbering them, and setting the pattern for his march through life and awaiting only the money and accolades to pour in. Whenever war threatens, there are those who enlist in the military and those who enlist in the military band. Not necessarily the safer choice, as tubas absolutely collect projectiles. Sousa took up the call to instruments and was instrumental in whipping up patriotic fervor for what, for want of a better term, was called American foreign policy during the heyday of our stab at imperialism. Mm-hmm. He was called the Pied Piper of Patriotism, the PPP, for good reason. Many hold that his pageant, the Trooping of the Colors, was as responsible for the Spanish-American War as the sinking of the battleship Maine.
Right.
But while it is possible to feel some ambivalence about the military bands which play you off to battle and hopefully back again, where are they in between? It is impossible to be ambivalent about a Sousa march. Resist though you might, something in you will keep step. Sousa took a traditional form, his phrase was hidebound, threw away the coda, armed it with a new type of band of his own invention, and
hidebound.
Whipped his superb like team that. Of horses straight through to the climax that never failed to bring an audience to its feet on either side of the Atlantic.
Yeah, don't you love a composer who uses the word hidebound?
Hidebound.
Another hidebound composition.
You don't hear that any more than you hear Fortnite.
Sure.
As a composer, Sousa considered himself fortunate to live in a time of war. It was good for business. In his autobiography, Marching Along, he writes, "Few of the great composers have written great marches because they lived in an atmosphere of peace, away from the barbaric splendor of war and the clash of swords. This exciting quality is missing in their work." Overall, he composed hundreds of marches, waltzes, dances, songs, humoresques, and operettas, but never a symphony, considering the form to be too florid and outdated, maybe hidebound. While transposing symphonic works for the band, he was fond of muttering about Mozart or Wagner, "My, how he could pad." To Sousa, the band was masculine. His certainly was, except for the visiting harpist or singer, while orchestras were feminine and therefore reluctant to accept new instruments. Traditional orchestras, he felt, too often ignored the listening public. Something
wait a minute. Which one was reluctant
never to accused of doing?
I just stop for just a second. Well, which one was reluctant to accept new instruments?
The orchestra.
The feminine orchestra?
Yeah, the feminine orchestra.
But, you know, you look at orchestras, you know, movies or something like that or whatever, or actual orchestras.
Yeah, but
there are a few women in them.
That's true.
Yeah.
And no saxophones.
No saxophones. Okay. Thanks for the clarification.
If military bands today get more tax money than the National Endowment for the Arts, and they do considerably, it is because of John Philip Sousa, who established a new branch of government with his music and his influence. Much of this had to do with the tirelessness of the man. He took after his Bavarian mother, he said, and not his Portuguese father, who, Sousa recounted, used to tell his wife when she begged him not to sleep during the day, "Elizabeth, days are for resting, nights are for sleeping." John Philip Sousa seems to have done neither. Concerts were 3 hours long with no more than 20 seconds of applause allowed between numbers, encores often exceeding the length of the program itself, and the whole of which often takes place twice a day in different cities virtually every day of a touring month. Sousa's skills as a conductor are legendary. His energetic displays seem to have been as much an attraction as the music itself. What the audience may have missed were his more subtle cues to the band. When Sousa flicked his ear lightly with his baton, it was neither tick nor flea, but a reminder to, say, a bass clarinetist that this was the exact point in the score where he screwed up during the matinee in Oswego. This was known as a taste o' the lash. The mistake didn't happen again, at least there. Sometimes he looked heavenward as if to ask if there were any hope for the trombone section, or was it just to scout for harpists? He was even more restrained in his praise, oftentimes awarding just the slightest of nods of the sort that means that was the way you were expected to do it. In his spare time, which you would think was very little, but nevertheless, he rode, shot trap, and invented instruments, the most famous of which bears his name. There is, by the way, a great deal of confusion surrounding the sousaphone. Sousa wanted an instrument that was omnidirectional, which to Michael Feldman, living as he does near the University of Wisconsin marching band practice field, means the damn things would never turn away from you. So he had some prototypes built. On one, the bell went like this. On another, it went like that. And on the third, it stood straight up. Guess which one Sousa chose?
Straight up.
Sousaphone players would later refer to it as the rain catcher. The sousaphone we think of today as the sousaphone is in fact not what Sousa thought of as a sousaphone.
No.
Its bell flags somewhat.
Yeah.
And it was only with the greatest reluctance that he sold his name to the company that cranked them out for cash up front and a percentage of the profits. The Stars and Stripes Forever, Sousa's most famous march, was composed on shipboard while returning from Europe in 1896, when his brain band performed the work in its entirety and repeatedly during the voyage. His brain lyricist supplied the words which repeated the phrase, kill the enemy, in the bridge, which he later deleted. The Washington Post march was the winning entry held in a competition by the newspaper of the same name, which also bestowed upon Sousa the accolade, the March King. Sousa sold his composition for $35, which he never stopped galling him. Semper Fidelis, written while Sousa was still a Marine, was his personal favorite and was used to march him off into the hereafter. The March King died March 6, 1932. While The Thunderer was a tribute to his friend and fellow Mason, Myron Parker, who it is to be hoped earned the soubriquet because of his loud voice. The King Cotton March was devised for an exposition to which Sousa's band had been invited, then, due to a concern about the cost, uninvited. They came and played anyway, bringing, as in all Sousa anecdotes, the house down and causing much chagrin on the part of his hosts. The Chariot Race of 1890, a rather experimental work, illustrates what Ben-Hur would have heard during the event in his brain band, if his brain band had been working. Hail to the Liberty, Hail to the Spirit of Liberty, and Jack Tar were performed on the band's first tour of Europe in 1900, where they became an international sensation. The latter, Jack Tar, was first ridiculed and then emulated by Debussy in The Gollywog's Cakewalk. Sousa's further ragtime adventures, With Pleasure, came from this same period, notable also for Sousa's testy condemnation of jazz. When it is good, it is very, very good, and when it is bad, it is horrid. The greater part of it is very bad. To find out why Sousa has been called the American Johann Strauss, you need only listen to La Reine de la Mer. Following the First World War, the Sousa Band toured abroad again only once. In 1922, Cuba, under the Cuban flag, the last movement of the Cubaland Suite reveals the influences of that trip and is best known for the cornet part that separates the men from the boy. Now, bring up the band. That's our composer of the week, John Philip Sousa.
Didn't you always want to play the whistle on that?
No, it's not a whistle. It's a piccolo.
Is it really?
Yes, it is.
I could do it with a whistle, I bet. A little practice.
Well, one can do anything with a whistle.
Thank you. That was wonderful. That was my favorite so far.
Who was that playing, by the way?
That was...
was it the Marine Band? No.
The Wallace Collection. John Wallace, conductor. Tom Kelly, clarinet leader.
Sounds British.
Yeah. Well, it's Nimbus Records, you know.
Yeah.
They no longer exist thanks to this.
Well, they do very good.
What do you know about Sousa releases?
If you knew Sousa like yeah. I knew Sousa.
Drove them out of business. Thanks very much, Lyle Anderson. Thanks all of you. And I appreciate it, you know, for putting up with a little disruption here. I don't know that it was nefarious. Well, let's assume that it was. It makes a good story.
Part of the metaverse.
This is a little nice, I think, for a Sousa. This is the chariot race mentioned earlier. Experimental. Imagine yourself in a chariot race, Lyle Anderson. It would sound nothing like this. Thank you all for listening. Thank you, Lyle Anderson. You're the man. For a race at this pace. Come on, you guys. Is the starting line or what? Get in the damn box there and get out there.
Thou forsake me, oh my darling. The star within.